Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's time for your Champions League take. We're recorded straight after the second semi-final. We had yesterday Manchester City 1, Real Madrid 1 at the Bernabeu, and tonight we had Inter winning away at San Siro. Very rarely we get to say that these days. A 2-0 win in Milan's nominal home game. My name is Jack Collins and I'll be your host then. I'm joined by the Rank God, Mr. Sam Tai. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, felt like a funny one, didn't it? Describing Inter as the away side with no away goals playing in their home stadium. But I guess that's technically the rule. I was trying to explain this to my wife before we started and she was also confused. I was like, they've made a change. And you know what? This is probably the only fixture it affects. But it did not make any sense whatsoever, did it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we should call it the San Siro when it's Milan and Giuseppe Meazza, when is it Inter? Just to really simplify things. Mm. That's how it's going to be simplified. And of course, our transfer guru, Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Good, mate. Yeah, I'm just waiting to see how good Inter are when they're at home. They're a very good away team, aren't they? What are they going to be like at home? Wow.
Who knows? Who knows? It must be absolutely unbelievable on their own pitch and all sorts of fantastic stuff. Let's start there, shall we? I mean, we had two very different games, I think, across the two nights tonight. But I think it's probably fair to start with the one we've just seen while it's fresh in the memory. And Sam, we're going to do one takeaway each now that we've come away from having to pick games and work it out between us. We now get to watch them all together. It's all very pleasant. You're going to start us off with this one and we'll work through it.
Sure, yeah. I'll kick us off and I'm going to talk about Rafa Leão, his absence, and how it impacted the game on multiple levels. And I think it's good to start with this one because it kind of sets the scene for the whole game, because it's the team news that comes in, you know, hour and 15 minutes before the game. There'd been rumours earlier in the day that Leão wasn't going to make it. He was like a lunchtime decision to see if he might be able to join up with the team. It turned out he could not. So Milan had basically one entire afternoon where they're not going to be doing too much training, really, let's be honest, the day of the game.
You'd hope, anyway.
You'd hope. To figure out how to attack this game without him. And that's what they really struggled with initially, wasn't it? And that kind of set the scene for this game, and the dominoes started falling. I have my sympathies with them in that he's their best player and he's their best attacker and he's their best shot at a goal, right? So, right, understand that losing him is going to be a massive problem. And the way they want to play, probably slightly more reactively and then spring him into space, it's obviously no longer possible. So the first thing they have to do is kind of get to grips with this psychologically. They have to kind of cope with this, swallow this fact. And that can be really difficult. And you can see sometimes in football that teams really struggle to get to grips with playing without their best player. And this was definitely the case in the first 20 to 30 minutes. And Milan looked pretty shell-shocked, didn't they, really? I mean, really, really poor. To me, it looked like they had absolutely no idea how to work the ball forward into a dangerous area or how to actually create a chance. And it was all sort of played into feet into a very busy, compact midfield area. There was no sort of stretching running behind. Inter could defend everything in front of them. Giroud was surrounded by three. Tonali was dribbling into traffic and into dead ends. And that's because no one was stretching the play beyond Giroud. So no one was opening the spaces for him to move into. But stupidly, he was just running into them anyway. And so, like, I understand that, like, he had to try and do something, but he kept running into the traps that Inter were setting. And of course, the knock-on effect here is that Inter are able to defend very aggressively and step forward. And you saw how Dumfries and DiMarco in particular were trying to pin Milan's players as they were stepping forward very aggressively. They had the centre back inside them on the channel. There was no running behind to worry about. They had the three across midfield and then they joined the three and they'd push and they'd trap and they'd pin and they'd push them to one side. And Milan just had no real idea how to deal with this, to be honest with you. And just sort of kept playing it to Giroud and they were trying to play this like impossible tight 1-2, weren't they, through the defensive line.
Yeah.
which would never, ever come off. So that's the effect of no Liao. Inter cannot play like that with if Liao is on the pitch. And Milan don't play anywhere near as badly if Liao is on the pitch. Now, there's a whole discussion to be had about how Milan defended, but like in terms of how Milan stuttered here initially and could not offer a threat for about an hour, 55 minutes, this was mostly down to the fact that they were unable to reload without Liao, and Inter were able to sort of identify that and prey on it and play really aggressively and push them into a corner, which they just couldn't get out of.
Yeah, I think it's interesting in that we saw so much of this in the Napoli game, right? Where Napoli were unable to get their, you know, fullbacks into the game. They were unable to get the players forward who normally can go and join the attack because the threat of Liao is so potent. And obviously this isn't new, but it just meant that it looked like Milan had gone for, okay, right, we'll sit in deep. And as soon as also the kind of knock-on effect of that is as soon as they concede early, 7 minutes in, you've conceded, it's like, right, we can no longer even play the sit back and soak it up and hope that maybe Salamakers goes on a mazy run that you're kind of expecting, I suppose, someone to step into. And then there's the injury to Bennacer and they have to change things. Yeah. And the change took so long to actually affect. Yeah. I think that it all just felt like everything fell apart. And, you know, as you say, the knock-on effect of that was that the midfield got swamped. Yeah. And actually, I think that's quite, you know, an interesting bit. I was going to talk about this. I had a secondary one as a backup. So I'll touch on that at the end. But I think kind of just as a knock-on and a kind of 1.A, if you will, to your point, is that what that all meant for Milan was that they couldn't get out of that midfield. And Barella just feasted. I think this is such an important point in that he was everywhere and suddenly he was winning the ball back in his own half, fine, knocking it off, and he'd marauded into all of this space. And his ability on that right-hand side to combine was freed up by the fact that Milan had no answers to that in midfield because there was no outball for the midfield to stretch.
Yeah, I mean, Milan were pathetic in midfield for most of this game, to be honest with you. You've got, you know, multiple chances. You've got the second goal where Tonali's just not following the runner. It's a nice piece of clever play. Like, Lautaro's dummy is really nice, but like Tonali is just the gap between the defensive line and the midfield, like the deepest midfielder there. We're talking 20 to 25 yards, and it's absolutely criminal. And then there's a chance later where Dzeko goes through one on one and Maignan saves. And that is also Tonali just kind of missing a runner. And there's this humongous gap. And I spent most of the first half saying, wow, I don't think I've ever seen Kjær and Tomori play this badly in my life. But it's partially not their fault. Like, if you do open up this chasm in front of them and allow the midfielders to just run through it at will, like, obviously they're going to struggle. They're pinned 1v1. One of them has Lautaro, one of them has Dzeko. Then you've got players like Barella, Mkhitaryan streaming through midfield and DiMarco stretching on the left. How are you supposed to deal with that? So obviously that's a problem. And Milan's midfield kind of disappeared because I feel like they convinced themselves that they needed to take the game by the scruff of the neck from an offensive standpoint. And players like Tonali were like, okay, it's on me. I'm going to dribble forward. I'm going to break this. I'm going to pick this lock. I'm going to break through these lines. And then he was taking himself out of the game, right? So they had no safety net, no midfield platform to play off. So they were so vulnerable in transition because they were then defending transition poorly because they're nowhere to be seen if the ball is turned over. And about an hour in, they bring Origi on. And actually, this changes everything because he makes a run in behind. 58 minutes he comes on, and then first run in behind, 60 minutes, 2 minutes later. And for the first time in the entire game, Inter's right side has to move backwards. They step backwards. And it was like, oh, Milan have just escaped down the left. And then they played a nice ball inside and fashioned a shot. And then what, 5 minutes later, Origi plays in Brahim Diaz on the overlap or underlap. And then they put it across and Tonali hits the post. It's like, damn it, Pioli. It was right there. It's not about the quality necessarily of Liao, although Salamakers and you know, Messias didn't do great. It's more about the space that you have denied yourself. Yeah, profile, and that's the really frustrating part here, that after 60 minutes or so, they sort of figured it out. But that's like two-thirds of the entire game gone.
Yeah, I was going to say, kind of as a final point on Liao, Dean, he might be back next week. Either way, if he's not, then you'd imagine Origi will now look at playing in that space because they will try and learn from the mistakes that they've made. But is it going to be a very different game? Because Inter will look at it, whether Liao or Origi starts, and they go, okay, maybe we can't be quite as aggressive as we were last time. We'll have to change the game as well. But they'll probably be quite comfortable doing that from a position at 2-0 up.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even have confidence in Origi doing that from the start. And given it'll be a different type of game as well, like you can't expect it to follow the same pattern. If Liao's not playing, like the chances of Milan overturning this are very, very minimal now. It wasn't like there was no chance to get back into this game. But I think if you look back on it now, you're like generally lucky that they came away with the 2-0. Like that's pretty much how I've come away from it. So it's going to be extremely tough. Now I'm going to go on to my point, because you're talking about midfielders a lot there. And I want to arrow in on Henrik Mkhitaryan. He scored a goal. So, you know, a lot of people talking about him
good
tonight.
Start.
Today. He's also followed up Edin Dzeko. And look, these two, 37 years old and 34 years old. I love to see this. I love to see the old boys rolling back the years. But I tell you what, I was watching Mkhitaryan in that first half, and I've just not seen this version of him very often. I mean, I don't watch loads of Inter Milan. You know, obviously I dip in and out just as the season rolls on. But in terms of obviously seeing him when he was in England with United and Arsenal, even when he was at Roma, I didn't see this. But it's just like he's got a new... I don't know, it's like he's reborn almost in this like central midfield role that he's got. I couldn't tell you whether he's like this every single week. I don't know. But watching him here, he had pace I've never seen before. Like he was like a box-to-box midfielder, which I've never seen before. And I was thinking, hang on, this is a guy that has been all over the place in his career, like literally in terms of teams and positions. So you're looking, he's like Shakhtar, Dortmund, United, Arsenal, Roma, right wing, left wing, attacking midfield, centre midfield. Like, I don't really know what a Mkhitaryan is. What I know is he does this job he did today extremely well. I don't know if it's down to maturity that he's been able to be disciplined in this role and you know, really pull it off this well. Maybe it's a realisation that he's got such extreme talent and he needs to make the most of it while he can because time's running out. But this was a big performance from him. And as I say, maybe because I've not really seen Mkhitaryan play in this role that many times, it really stood out to me. Look, I think if you look at the way he broke away for that second goal that Sam was talking about, he runs from deep. He runs from really deep and he runs fast. He gets in there to make sure if that ball falls where he wants it to fall, he's there. And, you know, Tonali is 23 years old. Mkhitaryan is 34. And he's gone past him like so easily. And it's not that he's fitter than Tonali. Like, I don't believe that Tonali like can't keep up with him if you try it. It's just that knack. It's a Champions League semi-final. This is a man that has literally been around the block and he knows how to manage games. He knows how to these things happen. And Tonali's still got that edge of inexperience, which has cost it, you know, throughout his AC Milan career. We've seen it many times that Tonali's not finished. Like, we haven't got the full package, and that's fine. He's still young. But central midfielders, this is what counts. And obviously, like, Inter won that battle here. And yeah, it was just really good to see a performance like that, particularly first half from Mkhitaryan, and it just caught my eye.
Yeah, I mean, I think anticipation there, you know, that's what it is, right? It's seeing the opportunity unfold before it's actually happened in real life. But it's an interesting point you raised about the Roma thing. And Sam, we watched him play for Roma. And often, if there was an injury in midfield, it would be Pellegrini that dropped in deeper.
Yeah, he didn't play like this for Roma. He didn't need
apart from in the Conference League final. And I remember you and I sitting there and going, he's dropped Mkhitaryan in deeper. That's rogue.
He got injured shortly after that.
So he didn't actually end up playing there. Pellegrini dropped back deeper in the end. But it just did make me think that he didn't play that role very often for Roma. But he did once when Mourinho stuck him in an unfamiliar role to maybe destabilise in the Conference League final, which I thought was interesting. Nice. But yeah, I thought he was magnificent tonight. And there's something about the balance of that midfield, right? Because actually, maybe if Liao is playing, and I think all of this ties back in, so it's quite nice. But you look at the midfield there and dropping Brozovic for Calhanoglu. Not that Calhanoglu hasn't played in that deeper role. He's kind of become that string puller in the sixth role of late. And I really like it. I like the way that he controls the game. I like the way he controls the tempo. Fine. But to not play Marcelo Brozovic, who is one of the best defensive midfielders on the planet, I think, by pretty much anybody's standards, in a Champions League semi-final. If Pep did that...
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. But you're right in that this midfield, in terms of like the players and the actual...
It looks lightweight, right?
Sorry, but it shouldn't work. On paper, it's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. Henrik Mkhitaryan, box-to-box 8, and Chad Hanodlu is the deep-lying 6. Get out. Varela basically playing as a winger half the time. It literally shouldn't work. But it is so good. It is so good. And it's been great from like January, basically. Whenever Çalhanoğlu stepped in, which was, I think it was basically start of this year, and Brozovic came back from the World Cup with a couple of injury tweaks and things like that. It's just like, I don't understand how it's happened. I just don't get it at all. But if it works, it works.
And it works. It very much works. All right, fair enough. All right, let's take my takeaway quickly. A third one, which is the fact that we talk about battles between players, and we often talk about this exact battle in the Milan derby when we're talking about the Derby della Madonnina, is the one between Theo Hernandez and Denzel Dumfries, aka two fullbacks who don't believe they're fullbacks. And it is one of those big battles every time we wonder how it's going to pan out. And it's gone both ways in across the derbies we've seen with both of these players in it. But tonight, I thought Dumfries had Theo on toast for the entire game. And part of it is the fact, as you say, Sam, he didn't have to continue checking over his shoulder to make sure he was having to covering runs. But also from sort of minute one, they snapped into a tackle together and Theo committed a foul. And the next minute, there was another massive crunching tackle and Dumfries came away with the ball and the ref didn't give it. And Theo threw his hands up in the air and I went, ooh, that's not a good idea. That's not a good sign. And it went like that for the entire game, every single time. And part of it, again, Barella dropping into those half spaces on that right-hand side and helping out and just being able to create those overloads with the Milan midfield not tracking backwards. But I did think that it felt like the kind of game where, you know, there's no Leao, maybe you get the ball to Theo and get him to get the ball into the box. Because if you can unleash him down that left-hand side and get him to actually start to deliver from those areas, that is probably your most reliable way of finding joy in this game in terms of trying to hit Giroud, trying to hit those tandems that we know that Milan can hit and have hit in big games before. That Theo to Giroud route is something tried and tested, not just at club level, but also on an international stage. And it just felt like Theo, I don't remember Theo crossing the ball into the box. Like that's how little I saw of him from an attacking sense. His only attacking contribution that I can remember was spooning a free kick so far over the bar, it may as well have ended up in the top bit of the cover. So, I should say, I apologize. But when you're looking at it, that was my big takeaway, that Theo was just completely and utterly nullified. And Dumfries did his famous playing as a false number two role and turning up in the box. I think he had more shots than the entire Milan team in the first half. That is not what you want to be hearing from your opposition right wing back.
No, that is not good. I mean, look, so no Leao, Theo nullified, Benacer off after 15 minutes. How do you even come close to putting together a winning plan if that's what you're dealing with?
Havoc Origi, mate. Havoc Origi. Only answer.
Some of it is beyond their control. Losing Leao sucks. Losing Benacer early sucks. But failing to game plan appropriately as a result, that's on you. And failing to get anything going in Theo in the absence of Leao, that's on you. That's criminal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's roll on to the second game this week then. Real Madrid 1, Manchester City 1 in the first leg at the Bernabeu. And it was a bit of a strange game, Dean, was my takeaway off this one. Not that it was bad. It was an incredibly high quality encounter.
It was awesome.
It was exceptional. But you look back at it and you think, Man City dominated the first half and went in 1-0 down. And then Real Madrid dominated the second half and conceded to make it 1-1. It was a game that kind of went against gameplay. You know, like the yin yang symbol, you know, where there's one, it's mostly one color and then there's the little dot.
Yeah.
That's how I felt about the game. That's how I would describe this game.
Do you know what's funny? I was looking at the managerial post-match interviews here from Pep and Carlo, and both were adamant that they controlled the game. Carlo, in his post-match, Carlo used the word control 4 times. It's like, no. No, yeah. But they're both adamant they've done it.
Yeah. Well, in their mind, they've both got out with a result that's fine, I guess. I think Pep's probably just edged that one, though, hasn't he? Mm. I mean, look, I'm going to start with looking at Manchester City. And look, coming into the game, it was all about Haaland. I mean, Marca had given him a massive build-up over in Madrid. They'd, like, you know, they'd turned him into this character, and that he was like landing in their territory and what he was going to do to them. And, you know, obviously there's been all the links of Haaland and Real Madrid in the past, and we all expect, I think, one day for him to actually end up wearing their shirt one day. So yeah, they had the whole build up, and he's expected that, you know, he's the guy that delivers on a stage like this, and he's done it loads of times, obviously, but this was an evening when he barely got a kick of the ball, and he literally had 21 touches of the ball throughout this fixture. And it was because Madrid restricted the service to him. I mean, they made sure that certain channels were closed to him, but more than that, that he had no spaces to run into that he likes to get into. Now, a lot's been made of the matchup with Rudiger. Look, Rudiger did a really good job without really doing too much, to be honest. He wasn't winning aerial duels. He wasn't
just
like
annoying.
Making great shadow. He was just extremely annoying. Yeah, it was exactly that. He was shadowing him, and he was like, it was a nuisance. He was just like a kid marking. It was like having a hyper kid who was actually really good at it and tall and big and strong. it was like everything that Rob Holding wasn't when he came up against him. You know, there's the thing going around where he's basically in his armpit. You know, Haaland's just trying to pretend he's not there. He's like,
it's like a fly, isn't it? Like go away, go away.
But it was noticeable that Haaland looked to me anyway, trying to get onto Alaba whenever he actually could. I felt always like Haaland, he ran off, you know, Rudiger's shoulder a couple of times, but I always felt to me like if he was going to have joy, it was going off Alaba's shoulder at the far post or something like that. There was that header that he came reasonably close with. But ultimately, this just was a game when Haaland wasn't really an option for Man City. They were going to have to look elsewhere. So that goal machine, the guy that they've turned to week in, week out, wasn't there. And for all the records that Haaland's setting, what we actually need to realise is that he's not actually the big game player for Man City. He's not. It's another
yet.
Man. It's
he's
Kevin De Bruyne.
Yet.
It's still Kevin De Bruyne. Those Arsenal games, those title clashes that are supposed to find us out, it's Kevin De Bruyne. You look at this one, it's Kevin De Bruyne. And like, look, this isn't his best season if you look at it as an overall campaign, but a City chase down this treble, while Haaland will definitely score more goals, look, it looks like it's going to be KDB that is going to be most decisive in whether they can actually go on and make history. Saw a stat, 11 of his 14 Champions League goals for Man City have come in the knockout stages. No Man City player has scored more in that respect. I just think, like, you know, the way he took that goal too, it's just beautiful, and it was actually quite refreshing. Like, this game wasn't won because of Erling Haaland. This was won by a midfielder doing what he's done for years and years and years. This is his trade. He's not having the greatest season in the world, but actually in the last few weeks, we've had a reminder of just how good he is. And Real Madrid got a reminder too that you can keep Haaland quiet if you want at the Etihad as well. We've got other players that are going to make a difference here. And going into that game now, like, I said it in the last pod when we previewed the Champions League, that I felt this had turned and that I was now making Man City favourites to go on and make the final. I absolutely believe it now after watching that first leg.
Yeah. Well, actually, this was something I was going to ask you about, because you and I both agreed on one thing, that was if this was a one-off game and if it was a final, we would have backed Real Madrid to get it done. Effectively, that's what we now have. We have a one-off game.
Well, it's at the Etihad. It's different. Like, a final will be in a neutral venue. Like, the Etihad is the Etihad, and, like, nobody wins there. Like, nobody's won there since World Cup. Like, they've made it a fortress. It's absolutely ridiculous, the numbers of goals that they're scoring there as well. Like, that's what makes this different. The second leg at home for Man City, when, especially when they've just played that well at the Bernabeu. Like, for me, obviously, like, Real Madrid can definitely still win this
game. Real Madrid, they can do what they want, but
I'm giving City the edge.
I enjoyed I enjoyed the cat and mouse between Thibaut Courtois and Kevin De Bruyne, because, you know, De Bruyne took three or four shots here. He escaped into different pockets and different channels at different points. Mm. And there was the one where he escaped down the right and smashed it across the across goal. Courtois, it was maybe offside, but we didn't need to check it. But I think it was a smidge off. We still took the shot, and Courtois, you know, saved it with his hand. You could see him at the afterwards in the replay. He was going, ow! He was like working his hands like, that was really painful. I mean, Kev really hit that one. And then so for the next one, he hits it even harder. It's absolutely remarkable. I mean, the strike, we haven't really talked about how good the strike was. And we actually, to be fair, was so busy moaning about Milan that it didn't give Dzeko his flowers either. I mean, what a goal.
Yeah, that's true.
What a goal. But I mean, this hit from Kevin De Bruyne is absolutely absurd. And like Dean, when you sort of talk about him as like the big game player, you know, it's about these moments. It's about these decisive moments. And when you hit a ball that hard, you can't help but be a bit decisive, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny.
The ball had flames coming off it. You know, like when you used to have FIFA Street and you used to have game breakers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where the goalkeeper couldn't save them. This
was funny
that.
Because, you know, Madrid's plan clearly is like restrict their chances. Don't let Haaland get his opportunities in the box. Like, don't let those come about. If they're going to have chances, let them have them from distance. De Bruyne's like, all right then, cheers.
So, yeah, the long shot was there for them basically all night.
It was there
for
them,
I mean, like in football, you have to, you have to give up space. Like you just have to make a choice. You're going to give up space in one area. And sometimes, you know, you want to restrict the space in behind. Sometimes you want to restrict the space between the lines. Sometimes you give up space out wide. Sometimes you allow long shots. It's like one of four. That's basically what it is. And Real Madrid went, okay, so let's restrict long shots. Like let's sit a midfielder in the channel in the half space either side. Let's marshal Haaland with two. Let's make sure we've got Kroos in one channel, and we've got Valverde in the other. And if we have to give them anything, let's give them long shots. Rodri nearly scored. De Bruyne scored. It's like, but what can you do against a team so talented?
You have to pick your battles, right? Yeah. And they picked their battles and thought maybe long shots. Well, they thought correctly that long shots have a lower chance of going in than shots closer to goal. Especially if that person is Erling Haaland. But yeah, Kevin De Bruyne is a slightly different case. I do enjoy just going back to the original bit at that point, Dean, that there was a BBC Sport little video of people filming around Madrid beforehand. And they were like, so what do you think of Erling Haaland? What do you think of it? And lots of people were like, oh, I'm scared. A lot of Madrid fans were like, oh, I'm terrified. And this one guy was like, not scared of him at all. And they were like, well, you're not scared of Erling Haaland. He's called 51. He was like, have you heard of Antonio Rudiger? And they were like, yeah. He was like, and the guy like shrugged as if it was like the most natural thing in the world. And all the comments in it were like, this guy's a moron. And all his comments are being deleted very quickly.
Absolutely nailed it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Unbelievable.
Right. Lead him in ranks.
Exactly. I'm going to talk about a slightly different battle that went on. Basically, my takeaway is, can I watch Vinicius Jr. against Kyle Walker every week for the rest of time? Because I had so much fun.
Today, they were high-fiving.
They literally afterwards, and I was talking to this, Lucy and I were watching it together, and we were talking about afterwards. She was like, why have they just gone over there? You know, that was all very like cheeky. And I was like, they've just had it, but they've obviously like, all he said to him is, I guess I'll see you next week then, bro.
Yeah. It was like, this is
my rainbow flicks.
I think he was complaining to Edison. I think I saw him mouth like, he's so fast, and pointed to Walker. I think that's what he said. Or he might
was really properly laughing, wasn't
I
he?
I really loved like the idea that if he
was cracking
that,
up, yeah.
If he did say that, he'd said it in English when both of them are Brazilian.
But he shouted it sort of at Kyle, like, you're so annoying.
I just loved it. And I think the thing is that, you know, Vinny scored a brilliant goal. He was exquisite, you know, last night. And yet, I still don't think he comprehensively won that duel, and which makes it incredible. I thought that City lacked for sort of offensive, you know, down that side, offensive kind of press down that side. They didn't really push in there. I mean, it helped that Camavinga was doing a one-man impression of an octopus. And anytime they did get into that side, he was just like, nope, by the way, I'm now an unbelievably good left back. It's like, if you watched the first football game yesterday, and you were like, who's that left back? And you were like, oh, it's Eduardo Camavinga. You'd be like, he must be one of the best left backs in the world. You'd be like, nope, he's a centre midfielder. He's just playing there in a pinch. You're like, okay, cool, right, no worries at all. He is unbelievable. But this battle between Vinicius and Kyle Walker was sensational. The rainbow flick made me laugh. Everything about it, there was a moment where Walker was sort of shadowing him back into his own half. And Vinicius, you could see in Vinicius' head him going, how do you reckon I could do it? how do you get it? And it like there was like a 5 or 6 seconds where Walker didn't press like the ball particularly offensively. And you're like, and you could just see Walker going, go on then try it. Go on then, I dare you try it. And it got to that point where like every time there was a tackle, they'd like smirk at each other. Or every time Vinicius got past him, he would smirk at him. And you're like, this is so good. And it defined the game in many ways. I thought it was a little bit of, you know, one half was Vinicius was on top. The other half, Walker was on top. It felt like a really nice microcosm of the entire tie played out in that, you know, there were cheeky moments, there were fun moments, there was a lot of real quality. And we get to watch it all over again, and I just can't wait. Kyle Walker, when he's playing like that, is just something else.
Yeah, I like Kyle Walker a lot. He's a good guy. Like, it always surprises me. Like,
I'm not sure he's a good guy.
Mate, honestly, I've met him a lot of times. So this is what confuses me. Like, you hear all these stories about Kyle Walker, and then I've met him, and it, like, so yeah, 3 or 4 times, and spent like good amounts of time, and he's like such a nice bloke. And like, considering it for a football, like, he's so down to earth. He gives you proper conversation, good answers, really like engages in conversation with you. And you're like, you know, feels like he's actually wants to be there, which is not normally the case with most footballers when they're in the middle of an interview. And I see like, he's, you know, the smile, like, there's loads of pictures of the smile on his face when he's doing like high-fiving with Vinny. And like, it's just so genuine. And I was like, that's what I like about Kyle Walker. Like, this is a guy that, like, he really does just love football. He really does. And, like, that's what it's about, especially when you're, like, you're on this stage. It's so competitive. It's so pressurized. And these two are just having a laugh. Ridiculous.
Yeah, unbelievable. That's real quality. That's how you know you're elite, when you can have a laugh while you're doing it at the same time. It's very much Lewandowski and Royce smirking at each other the top of the Clásica, isn't it?
It's also very much it's our absolute least favorite game respect game at the end, isn't it? Horrific tweet that we've seen many, many times. That video of them high-fiving is what that tweet was built for.
Really was.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right, Sam, what's takeaway number 3 and the final one for today's episode?
I'm going to talk about Pep Guardiola, and I'm going to give him a little bit of praise because he kept it simple. And when I mean simple, I mean like possibly as simple as he has ever kept anything in his entire life. And this contextually is very important given the stage that we're on. So for those of you that don't know, there is a real unique sense of anticipation that surrounds the team sheet drop of a Manchester City 11 on a Champions League knockout game, or in previous years, Bayern Munich and Barcelona, because we've ultimately been trained as an audience to expect something absolutely ludicrous and crazy to happen. You know, and no matter where you stand on the sort of Pep overcomplicates things scale, I think we can all agree that often he does something different. And different doesn't always work. So we're all looking at these team sheets at this stage of the season, at this stage of the competition. We're all wondering what he's going to do. And there's a real sense of anti-climax for those that fish for that kind of humour, because City's 11 was bang on what everybody predicted. I mean, Nathan Ake's injury has informed it somewhat, but, you know, so there was a potential for maybe something a bit odd, but Walker was always going to get paired with Vinicius. Akanji was always going to move over to the left. And then everything else picks itself, right? Bernardo Silva's clearly won the job against Riyad Mahrez on the right. This team picks itself. And it did. Which doesn't always happen. So there's your first victory. And like, the crowd were a bit disappointed there. But then obviously City played really well, I thought. City played better for a longer time in this game than Madrid played better, is probably how I'd put it. They had their spells, but I think City were better overall. And I thought, you know what? At the end of the game, Pep will be walking away from that thinking, I've got a 1-1 draw at the Bernabeu. Ties alive, back at the Etihad. Didn't implode, didn't panic. Rodrigo didn't score 3 goals. We've done all right there. City fans should be pretty happy. People should be impressed by that. And then I went on Twitter. I see this screenshot of the bench that City did not use. They didn't make any substitutions. And I see people screaming about, they've got Foden and Mahrez and £600 million worth of talent and they didn't use a single one. What is he playing at? How on earth can he do that stuff? And I'm just sat there giggling because, again, it's like, Well, he's pretty happy with his team's performance.
Yeah, they were playing quite well.
They were playing pretty well. So he was just like, oh, I'm going to leave them because they're doing quite well. And so for once, he's done what everybody asks of him. He overcomplicated nothing. What's the what's the opposite of overcomplicated? Oversimplified.
Undercomplicated.
Undercomplicated. Simpler. He has
simplifying
as simplified as possible. And he's done really well. And people are fuming.
That's ridiculous, though, fuming. Isn't it? People are never happy. That is annoying.
Absolutely fuming. But like, to a more serious point, substitutions are gambles. They affect games. Every substitution you make affects a game of football. Ideally, it affects the game in the way that you plan
positively.
It to. Sometimes that doesn't happen.
I watched Fulham make 5 substitutions at the weekend and completely implode, so I can understand Pep's reticence. After he saw what happened to Shane Duffy, he's like, I can't bring Phil Foden on here. He might Shane Duffy it.
I mean, yeah, that's exactly what would have been going through his mind. But like, even something as simple as pulling Mahrez on for Bernardo Silva, like for like position wise, or Foden on for Jack Grealish, like for like position wise, like you never quite know what the domino effect is going to be. And you never quite know how a substitution is going to affect the game. So if you're happy with how it's going and you know it's a 180-minute game or more, then you don't actually have to make any changes. And this is just one of those things that I think, especially in the 5-sub era, people are not getting. They're just not getting. But I just want to give Pepper a little bit of praise there because he just did the most obvious thing, put the most obvious team out. His team played pretty well. He saw it. He was happy. He didn't risk any changes. And now they're in a situation where if they win 2-1 or 1-0 at the Etihad, they're through to the final. He's done all right.
I wouldn't want to predict the starting 11 for their game at the weekend against Everton. I think that is an impossible task. Pep Roulette is hard at the easiest of times. But sandwiched in between these two games, and he's just made no subs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ortega back in.
Phil Foden might get a run out.
Haaland play?
I wouldn't play Haaland. I wouldn't play De Bruyne. I wouldn't play Grealish.
There is an element of they have to win a league title as well, lads.
But this is the balance, isn't it? This is why it's tough. This is really difficult balancing act he's got.
I would start Haaland. I would not start De Bruyne. I would start Alvarez in the midfield. I would start Mahrez on the right. I would start Foden on the left. They're the changes I would make immediately. I would make whatever changes were physically possible in terms of the back line, but I'm not sure if that involves chucking Rico Lewis back in or whoever that looks
How long is it since you watched Aymeric Laporte play football? I mean, on Football Manager, I'm putting him straight in, but would I do that this weekend in real life? Probably not.
That is mad that this side is this good and Aymeric Laporte's just chilling. I'd actually fully forgotten he was there. That's how long it's been. Yeah. That's how long it's been since I've seen Laporte play football. Yeah, I would put him in anyway, so that's right. Fair enough. Look, there's enough changes to think about on that one. But with that, I think it's probably time for us to call it a day. And all that's left for me to do is to say thank you so much to everyone for tuning in today to Champions League Takeaway. We hope you are enjoying these extra episodes. Thank you so much to the Rank God, Mr. Sam Tai.
Cheers, buddy.
Thank you so much to our transfer guru, Mr. Dean Jones.
Thanks, mate. We've got a Patreon to record in about 8 hours. So we better go to bed and get ready for the next show we're going to record.
Indeed.
Come and join us, people.
There's no rest.
Listen to the Hangover show.
The Hangover show in the morning, recorded straight after this one at 2 in the morning. It's what we do. I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we will see you very shortly. Take it easy, gang.